resuming our hearing on Senate Bill 5538. Mr. Nicewander, any opening comments other than to invite Bill McGee to summarize the governor's budget on Fish and Wildlife Division? That's it?
That's it.
Thank you. Bill?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services, and I'll go through my handout on the Fish and Wildlife Division. The governor's recommended budget, $4.9 million general fund, is a 15.5% reduction from legislative adopted, and it's about a 22% reduction from current service level. $3.4 million lottery funds, increased 3.4% from legislative adopted and 6.1% from current service level. The total fund budget of approximately $21 million is a reduction of 12.3% from legislative adopted and 10% from current service level. The budget here, as you see on page 3, it's 59% other funds, 1.3% federal, 23.4% general, and lottery 16.3%. The other fund sources, largely the transfer from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, also funds from the Marine Board, Department of Environmental Quality, and the Parks Department. Federal funds are primarily the Corps of Engineering for contract services.
Sure.
Senator Trow.
Are those transfers generally from general funds that they're transferring, or are they from a variety of funds?
The ODFW funds would primarily be from licenses for fishing and hunting. Marine Board would be the receipts from either their administrative receipts from the marine tags, or probably more from the gas tax transfer they get based on that.
Okay, so virtually none of it is.
It's primarily other funds. Yeah, right. On page 4, again, the governor's recommended budget is 12.3% reduction in total funds. The budget for this division reduces the division strength by 21 officers, or 16.4% of the total. That eliminates seven general funded officers and 14 other officers due to revenue limitations. Of those, seven are Measure 66 lottery fund supported, six were funded with Department of Fish and Wildlife transfers, and one was established through private grant funds that have since expired. The budget shifts one sworn pilot position to the Human Resources Division. It restores four sworn positions that were eliminated in current service level due to revenue limitations to avoid further reductions in strength. There's one ballot measure 66 lottery fund position restored, and three Marine Board positions are restored.
So let me ask about the pilot position. Is this something that went along with the King Air, or is
it's an administrative transfer to take it from the Fish and Wildlife Division to administer it really under the superintendent's more direct control under the
human Are there resources. Other pilots?
There are several other pilots. Most of the rest of the aircraft unit is assigned to the Fish and Wildlife Division. There are
four Fish and Wildlife planes.
And how many pilots?
I believe three of those pilots are assigned to the Fish and Wildlife Division.
What's the magic of shifting the one to the Human Resource Division and retaining three in Fish and Wildlife?
Danny looks like he wants to respond. So.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Danny Bisgard, Budget Director. The rationale there is we're trying to keep Fish and Wildlife a budget as whole as we could with the aviation assets that they have, those pilots that they have, and the aircraft that are assigned there. We shifted, we felt operationally, the lieutenant that was overseeing the aircraft program, one of his main duties, of course, is to fly the King Air. We felt that was better reflected in the budget and human resources or administration portion of this budget. So the one position was transferred from Fish and Wildlife to Human Resources to oversee the King Air operation.
What are the other aircraft that you all fly?
Senator Miller, members of the committee, Cynthia Cote, Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. Are you referring to where the positions are or who?
No,
they
what
are?
The type of aircraft? It's on our.
Do you have a list there of the?
I do. Thank you. Okay. Please proceed, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, single program unit on page 6. The breakout here again is primarily personal services for the staff costs and a 15.9% for services and supplies and 5% for capital outlay. Page 7, walk you through the development of the governor's budget. emergency board actions through April 2000, the salary adjustment again, and establishment of 5 Fish and Wildlife officers and an early emergency board that were phased in the later part of this biennium. Current service level budget adjustments, position standard inflationary changes, the vehicle replacement cost exception, standard state government service charge adjustments, the phase in for the positions that were established during the 99-2001 biennium, and again, revenue reductions, ballot measure 66 supporting 8 officers, funds transferred from Department of Fish and Wildlife supporting 6, fund transferred from the Marine Board supporting 3, and the private grant funds that supported 1 officer.
A question regarding the vehicle replacement cost above standard rate. We had that.
Seen that in
other budgets and other
divisions here.
What is the usual vehicle for the Fish and Wildlife? I guess I was assuming it was a truck, but that's not necessarily.
Senator Miller, that's correct. It's a half-ton pickup, and it changes from biennium to biennium, obviously cost and make.
And whoever is who makes that truck?
I think we've had Fords, and we've currently just purchased Chevrolets.
They went beyond, as I read this, the standard rate.
The increased rate of cost has been growing larger, greater.
Lower
than
or it's more than you anticipated.
Yeah.
Is that what we're saying here? And you, I guess you shop around and you ask Ford whether or not they want to compete with Chevy for selling you a truck and the same equipment. And
Senator Miller, that's correct. We do put out a bid. That happens at our central install level.
Okay. Senator Trow?
How is it working that we're doing the e-board added the 5 Fish and Wildlife officers, and then we're going to be reducing officers as well? Are the ones that are added new ones and they're going to remain, or what happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, those 5 officers would have been established January 1st, 2001, and as the 75 patrol officers, they weren't hired. And the funds were used to, as reported, the January board to balance other issues in the department.
So nobody has been fired?
Nobody will be laid off in any of these reductions here or any other division.
Okay. Well, did we establish 5 Fish and Wildlife officers, as this says?
They were the authority and the funding was established to start in the last 6 months of the biennium.
Okay.
It was a November 99 emergency board that established those, but the phase-in date was...
But not new people in those positions?
Well, they would have been new people. We would have been hiring new folks into those positions had they been filled.
Okay. Maybe you'll explain it better. I still don't know. We're hiring here and we're letting go over on the other hand.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. The emergency board authorized the hire of these 5 officers in January 2001. So the position authority was established, and short of revenue restrictions, that would have continued. When we calculated the current service level and determined that we didn't have sufficient funds to cover, the decision was made not to fill those 5 positions, not to hire the bodies for the positions. And so they are, the authority is, as well as the funding is, was eliminated in current service level.
Thank you.
Do you want to say something, Larry?
Jared Miller. Senator Troy, just in response, authorized but not hired. The funding that was there for those, there was $300,000 general fund that was provided for that. The department used that in their rebalance plan, and as a part of the emergency board recommendation, we unscheduled $300,000 of their Fish and Wildlife revenue in this biennium to allow it to carry over into 01-03 to allow the legislature to help us with a plan to mitigate this cut.
Okay.
And so I'm working with natural resources staff who oversees the distribution of Fish and Wildlife Division revenue as well as ballot measure 66 revenue to see what areas of potential restoration could occur when the co-chairs allow that to occur.
Thanks.
Okay.
It's getting clearer.
Moving on then to page 8. The policy package is package 90, the reduction package. Eliminated 7 sworn positions, $943,000 general fund. Anticipates the retirement of sworn officers again for savings of $123,600 general fund. It's a small amount of other funds. adjust for underfills in sworn positions for $130,887 general fund, and eliminates empty other funds limitation that was established for contracts that are no longer in place. It's $1.5 million other funds, $78,000 federal funds, 15 part-time seasonal positions, 4.66 FTE. Those were positions in funds that simply weren't being used. Package 112, education differential. The OSPA differential is $48,336 under general fund, $59,128 lottery funds, and $74,856 other funds. The package 113, a fund shift package that increases the transfer from the Marine Board for $398,697 other funds and restores the three positions that have been eliminated in current service level. Page 9, policy package 115, restores one ballot measure 66 lottery fund position that was eliminated in current service level, $137,287 lottery funds. And package 167 shifts the pilot to from this division of human resources, $229,000 general fund and one position shift from Fish and Wildlife Division to human resources. In terms of fee of revenue changes, the revenue reductions are partially restored with Marine Board and ballot measure 66 lottery funds, and there are no technical adjustments in this division.
Questions?
What's the rationale behind the shift of the pilot again?
As Major Bisgard indicated, this pilot was not doing fish and wildlife work primarily. He's piloting the King Air and supervising the overall aviation program. So the department felt it was more appropriate to supervise him in the Human Resources Division.
Okay. Lieutenant?
Chair Miller. Members of the committee, again, I'm Cynthia Koch, Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. Mr. McGee has really covered most of our programs, and in the interest of time, I understand you want to move along here, so I'll try to cut to the quick here. We are, the governor's recommended budget does cut 22 positions, and on page 9 of my testimony, it does list where those positions are, as well as the pilot's position. And lastly, the budget notes cover those allocation of resources. We did prepare a plan and presented that plan to the October 99 Emergency Board. Measure 66 lottery funds were tracked and used for those purposes allowed. We continue to track those funds, and we have established a separate cost accounting system. Minimum staffing. Mr. McGee kind of explained that a little bit, that at the beginning of the 99-01 biennial, we only had 93 field staff. There are currently 117 FTE at this time. The division is meeting the minimum staffing that was established by the 99 legislature, but we did not meet the maximum staffing because the governor's recommended budget did cut those 22 positions, and we were unable to fill the five enhancement positions because there was no recruit school this past January. And regarding the scheduling of staff, as I explained on Thursday, we use the itinerary to maximize our officers' work schedule and the flexibility to provide enforcement at all times and locations that are most efficient and effective to protect the resource. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Lieutenant, not quite like the phrase at the wedding about speak now or forever hold your peace, but I've asked anyone who comes and testifies who's in charge of a division to tell me whether or not, one, they're satisfied with the allocation and the appropriation they have received, and if you're not, understanding that our mission is to try to do the best we can for Oregon and for its future, and not just a particular individual who is, in all due respect, helped outline his priorities. Do you have any disagreement with the way things are spread out or the appropriation that's been made for this particular division?
Chair Miller, Members of the committee, as a state employee, we do support the governor's recommended budget. But obviously, a 22 position cut is going to have a marked effect on whether or not we can provide enforcement for the protection of fish and wildlife resources.
Do you have any, if you looked around at this budget in total for the entire department or any other budgets that we review in this legislature that you might be aware of, is I get from your comment that perhaps you would be more comfortable if some of these positions were restored. You think you could fulfill your mission perhaps even better if you had these additional positions. Is that correct?
Chair Miller, that is correct.
And yet you're here to suggest that you're just going to go quietly and support this budget? Is that? And I understand the difficulty you're in, but so are we. And if we don't hear, you know, get constructive advice on how we might repair the prospective damage, then we'll probably just pass it pretty close to as is. And this is the chance for change.
Chair Miller, that is a tough question and one harder even to answer. Do we have a priority list of how we would fill those? Yes, we do. I have a specific list of, you know, which position I would fill. Over a year ago, we took a look at if we had to cut positions, where they would come from. And I guess in filling those, we would fill them in the reverse order, if that makes sense.
Senator Trow.
Well, I was going to ask a question that maybe not quite as direct as that, but it I think goes to the same thing, and that is, what are the consequences of having to make these cuts? What kinds of things will not get done that need to get done, and how serious is that?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, certainly losing one position in a specific area would just devastate and decimate the kind of enforcement we would be able to provide. In some cases, this might be the only officer taken out of a specific area, and that means that fish and wildlife concerns would not get the same timely or complete just because of lack of personnel. In some areas, it might have less of an impact because it may be one of six or seven people from that particular office. Can I tell you today specifically which tasks will not occur? I cannot answer that for you.
But you know, substantially important ones will not happen, especially in some areas.
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, that would be correct. Our people right now are fairly well spread out over an immense area of our state.
Well, having noticed the staff pointed out to me the fleet of aircraft that you have beyond the One King Air that is going to be sold, what if I said to you, well, maybe we'll sell both of them. Maybe we'll fetch another $900,000. And if I said to you, you know, if I sell that, I'll plow that money into your division. Do you think that'd be a good idea?
Chair Miller.
Those are nice plans, but it looks like you've got some others.
Chair Miller, members of the committee, if that's what you told me to do, I guess I would have to make a workable situation out of that.
That's as good as you're going to get.
I mean, apparently.
Just
be something they teach in Monmouth. Are you, any other questions? Well, we thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. And I want you to continue seriously to think about ways we can improve this budget. Because that's at least my personal position, that you know what's best for the citizens of this state, and saluting to one individual or another is not necessarily in the best interest of all Oregonians if you have a reason to disagree. And I'm just anxious to hear the, get some helpful hints, I guess. So I thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
It's an extreme privilege to have the great high co-chair. Do you have my free donuts for you or something? Is that why you came in?
No, I wasn't aware that fine. You had that.
Sugar. Yeah, I did it for you. All right, we'll move into the forensics division. Mr. Nicewender, another area of your expertise.
Chair Miller, before you today, you'll have Captain Tom Dixon from the forensics division to talk to you. I've placed before you some handouts that just give you some summary information on the expenditure history for this division. This is a division that is largely driven by workload provided by locals, law enforcement, cities, and counties. And you'll see that over the last three biennia, there has been a significant increase in the number of FTE assigned to this unit from 159, 97, 99 to 199 in proposed for 2001-2003, approximately 26% growth to deal with that workload. In terms of their budget issues, their expenditure patterns, as we've talked about earlier, are within the budget. They do use some double fills, and they'll talk about that, primarily due to reclasses and late establishment of positions in the personal information system. They do use some temporaries also for workload purposes and to recruit people when they're going to have some vacancies. They have a 1 to 7.78 span of control for their managers, and this budget was asked to take a $550,000 reduction in the governor's recommended budget. They have four policy packages that are outlined in the work session papers. They primarily relate to education differential, some funding and reclass. There is one forensics workload package that deals with five other funded positions, and a ballot measure 5 background checks package that deals with 10 other positions that they'll discuss in detail with you.
Thank you and welcome.
Thank you. Chair Miller and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Dixon. And I'm your director of your Forensic Services Division. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about the work we do and represent the men and women of the division. I realize we're trying to move along with time, so I'm going to hit on the high points. I'll be working from my testimony. If you have any questions, obviously, I'm here to ask them or to answer them. The division is part of the Intergovernmental Services Bureau, as you can see on the chart to my left. And also attached to this under Appendix 1 is the organizational structure attached to my testimony, is the organizational structure for the division. The primary purpose is pretty straightforward, is to provide quality scientific, technical, and investigative support to the criminal justice system through forensic analysis and the compilation of criminal offender information. We have two primary purposes. You can see in my testimony their statutory authority is fairly broad. I would like to take a few minutes and talk about how that authority translates to actually the work we do. And again, we provide two unique functions. The first function being our identification services section on the record compilation, and the second being the managing the forensic laboratories. In 1939, that legislature established our responsibility to oversee and provide forensic services in the state. Our customers include is broad-based. We are a sole-source service in both of those areas. We have over 5,500 police officers at Oregon's more than 200 police agencies, 11,000 fire personnel, 36 district attorneys, 330 courts. We do background checks on teachers for more than 600,000 K-12 school children. We do background checks and other regulatory functions such as realtors, things such as that. We also do the firearm insta-check for the state. If you're going to buy a long gun or a handgun through a licensed dealer, you'll do that through this division. To provide these wide range of services, we really have three main components. Our first is our identification services second. Our second is our implied consent unit or our breath test program. And the third is the forensic laboratory. The record repository itself is located here in Salem and maintains the state's only fingerprint-based record system. When a person's arrested and convicted, those fingerprints are taken, they come to your central repository, and we maintain that. We also maintain the AFIS system that is automated fingerprint identification system that links Oregon with seven states. So again, we search through that computer system. We provide, like I say, the database access to regulatory functions, to criminal agencies, in all criminal justice agencies, and again, as I mentioned, the Firearm Institute. Our second broad-based program is the implied consent or breath test program. And we support, we have 160 intoxilizers around the state in police departments and sheriff's offices, and basically support more than 20,000 drunk drivers that are arrested every year. We support those agencies in providing those breath tests. The final component is our laboratory system. We have laboratories located in 8 locations in the state: Bend, Coos Bay, Central Point, Ontario, Pendleton, Portland, Salem, and Springfield. We have one DNA laboratory, and that does all the DNA work for Oregon, and that's located in our Portland lab.
Can I interrupt for just one moment, Captain?
Yes, sir.
The figure of the 20,000 drunk drivers arrested annually, is that arrests or is that convictions annually?
Chair Miller, that it would be arrests. On an average, about 20,000 drunk drivers are arrested in Oregon each year, and we process those through our breath test instrument.
Do you have any figure on what is the prosecution success rate, I guess?
Chair Miller, I do not. I can obtain that information if you'd like.
Just casual interest. I'm not sure it changes your, doesn't change your testimony. You got 20,000 people you apparently check.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
The laboratories, I'm on page 4 of my testimony. The laboratories, they provide, again, the only full spectrum of forensic analysis. There are some other laboratories in the state that provide limited services, such as Portland Police Bureau. They do crime scene work, and they also do compare fingerprint analysis, but they do not do drug analysis, DNA, or any of the other full spectrum. So we are the only service there. And you can see in my testimony that it's very wide in our responsibilities. We have two main performance measures for the division. First, one is customer satisfaction, and the second is our turnaround time. And I'm going to go into a little more detail a little bit later on each one of those. Also, on page 4 talks about how those two link to a number of state benchmarks. I'm not going to go into those. I can if you'd like, but I think they're fairly straightforward, dealing with public safety and regulating the safety of our citizens. Under our service delivery, the majority of the criminal work we do, in fact, 89%, is for police departments, sheriff's offices, and other agencies other than the Department of State Police. So one of our challenges is as the state budget is very tight, city and county budgets may have some growth involved. So that it really affects our division as we try to serve 89% of our work to those customers. On page 6, there's a chart that just demonstrates the distribution of our work. Talk a little bit about performance measures on customer satisfaction. We do that.
Senator Trow, excuse me, Captain.
Do you try to recapture your costs when you do work for other levels of government?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, no, we do not. We are, for the most part, general funded, and there is no cost for this service.
You're providing that to other levels of government as part of your function without getting compensated.
That's correct, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
If they had to buy that service, what would it amount to? Local government had to buy that service of forensics lab, what would it amount to? Do you have an approximate amount that would be worth?
Chair Miller, Senator Hannon, obviously about 90% of our budget would be to support. So it would be roughly 90% of the budget, which is, we have $21 million general fund.
$21 million general fund, about 90% of that.
Something. That's correct, Senator.
Okay. Just wanted to remind the good friend from county government who walked out of the office.
I think he passed out.
Yeah. Another additional benefit that local government receives.
That's right. Please proceed, Captain.
Thank you. To on our first performance measure, customer satisfaction, that's to me a critical component is how well is our service being delivered and received. And we have attached in your packet is a survey. We print this every 6 months. And in this case, we surveyed 311 of our customers and asked them, how are we doing? And we asked questions such as, did we deliver it in a timely manner? Did it meet your needs? Was it professional? And you can see by looking at this, our scores for the most part are very, very high in customer satisfaction.
See you later.
The second performance measure we have, I'd like to add, out of a 4 this last 6 months, we had a 3.73 score. So I'm very proud of that score. Second performance measure is turnaround time. That's a critical component of the services we deliver. If we're conducting a background check for, let's say, a healthcare provider, a nursing home, if it takes us too long a time, that potential hiree or applicant moves on to another job, so that's of no value. Secondly, if we cannot provide timely service to crime scene or criminal analysis, the chances go down with every day that passes in solving a crime. So timeliness is a critical component. And as an example, laboratory analysis currently averaging 27 days on the work we do. Another example, our firearm InstaCheck program, our response back to federal firearm license dealers averages 3.58 minutes. So we track each one of those. We're very concerned about the timely service. In addition to service, the program accuracy is also essential. We cannot be right 98% of the time when people's lives, people's careers, going to jail, courts. So our accuracy has to be 100% in that, and we devote a lot of time and effort to that that effect. Division administration. This division is directly administered out of our general headquarters. And the reason for that is we want our 8 laboratories to function as a single system. We don't want Ontario to function in one manner and Portland to function in a different manner. We work very hard to provide the very best service to all Oregonians. And as mentioned, our span of control is 1 to 7.78.
Could you speak just briefly to the need to maintain the 8 different labs?
Senator Miller, Chair Miller, if I may, our laboratory system was designed, started in the 1930s. It was added to in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It is not necessarily designed today for the 21st century. There's a couple components that I would say as considering your forensic services. First, service. Second, efficiency. And third, politics. These laboratories, because they are locally, they are established in the local community, they have a very strong customer base. We, back in the early 90s, we attempted to close a laboratory. There was quite a constituency that came to this body, and we ended up keeping that laboratory open and closing something else. So there could be some efficiencies to relook at that system, but it is very, it's very strongly supported in the local community.
Thank you.
Speaking of efficiencies, I'm on page 8 and wanted to talk quickly about that. What we've tried, what I've tried to do is to take an 8 laboratory system and make it as efficient as I can. We've looked at, like I say, the single system approach, so they all work collectively. We've eliminated functions in some laboratories to centralize them where they can be more cost effective. Less equipment required, less training required. We've done a number of things, and you can see on page 8 what have we accomplished. I want to talk one about performance benchmarks. We have established an expectation for our employee in each discipline. If you're performing chemistry or a chemical analysis of a controlled substance, as an example, we expect you to perform 1,336 of those analyses a year. And I don't care if you're in Portland or if you're in Ontario. That's our expectation. DNA unit, we expect you to perform 84 analysis a year. So we have that in each one, so there's very very clear direction on that. And the last point I wanted to mention there on the bottom of page 8, we are working collaboratively with all our customers to eliminate unnecessary services. One of the problems in the criminal justice system, a person may be arrested, but they may not be prosecuted. There may be something in the process that they cut a deal, it's dismissed. So we're trying to work very closely with our district attorney partners to make sure that we only perform the analysis on the cases that are going to be prosecuted.
Sure.
Senator Trow.
Sometimes the analysis needs to be there first before they know whether they're going to prosecute or not.
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, you're absolutely correct. So some of that has to happen.
Representative Doyle.
Thank you. The expectations you said for the numbers of analyses, are your employees meeting those expectations?
Chair Miller, Senator Doyle, yes. In fact, our expectations are partially driven through historic data as well as what our future expectations would be. So yes, they are meeting those expectations. We do find that those in a larger, more automated work environment exceed the expectations, where those in a smaller one-on-one environment may be slightly below. But overall, yes, I'm very pleased with those, with meeting those expectations. Now, that concludes my program overview. Now I'll turn it over to Bill McGee.
All right. Bill?
And Mr. Chair, Bill McGee, DASC, for the record. Page 2 in the handout, as mentioned, the governor's recommended general fund budget for this division is $21.1 million. That's a 3.1% increase over the legislatively adopted budget and a 1.4% reduction from current service level. Total budget is $30.6 million. That's 7.3% increase from the legislatively adopted and 2.9% above current service level. The budget for this division is 69% general fund and 31% other funds. Several different sources for those other funds. The criminal fines and assessment account has a statutory distribution for forensics support. There's transfer from the Teacher Standards and Practice Commission for background checks on teachers. Department of Education, the same thing. There's transfer from the Employment Department, the Board of Investigators, and there's revenue received for individual checks from the instant check system and handguns, the concealed weapons, open records checks, expungement fees, a variety of other funds issues. Page 4, to summarize the budget for the division, again, it's a 7.3% increase in total funds from the alleged adopted budget. The governor's recommended budget eliminates 2 forensic scientists and 1 criminal history records position and reduces service and supplies, all general fund. It increases other funds positions for regulatory workload in the identification services section. It implements ballot measure 5 passed in November, increasing the background checks on firearms purchases, and continues planning for a new forensics lab and medical examiner's facility in the Portland area. There was authorization for that during the emergency board during the interim. We are proposing no additional funds at this time until we have a better idea of what the plans will look like and what the cost for that will be.
Senator Trow.
Mr. Nicewander's analysis, he mentioned both double positioning and temporaries. Does the agency overly rely on either of those things? Can you talk to that, and can also the agency talk to that?
Let Tom do the part of the name.
Okay. Chair Miller, Senator Trow. Yes, we do utilize double fills, and this division had utilized 32 in the last, in this biennium. 14 temporaries were also utilized. And to give you an example of how we utilize a double fill, we're moving from a transition from a sworn laboratory system to a non-sworn laboratory system. In our Central Point laboratory, we have a latent print examiner that the position is a sworn. The new person we hired is a non-sworn. So until we can get that position reclassed as a non-sworn, we are in fact double filling this person on another non-sworn position. The money's there, but we're simply not using the sworn position because it's a non-sworn employee. That is one example.
That's sort of a bookkeeping thing, is that it, more than anything else?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, yes, part of it is the personnel rules. We also use double fills, though, in other areas, such as one of the problems, the challenges we have in forensics is a 6-month to a 2-year training curve before that individual can actually begin to produce work. We do use some double fills if we have the money, we have the position authority to hire, we have an opportunity to hire early. Sometimes we will use a double fill in that area as well.
Suppose we say to you, we don't like double fills. What are your alternatives? How do you manage without double fills?
Chair Miller, Senator Troe, the technical aspect of what I described to you first of personnel issues, I don't know how we would do it there by plugging a person of the wrong classification into that. I don't know how we would handle that. The other piece that would create difficulty for me, though, is a workload piece where I have the work, I have the money, the position authority is there or is coming, and I'm doing a short-term double fill. That would create an operational problem for me to get the work done.
You don't see any alternative. At least you can't visualize one.
Chair Miller, Senator Troe, what I see is to minimize those as much as possible, but still have some flexibility in that area if possible.
What about the temporaries? Do you overly rely on temporaries?
Chair Miller, Senator Troe, I don't believe we overly rely on temporaries, but we do utilize them, and I think we utilize them very effectively. And I'll give you an example where most of these temporaries, the 14, are utilized. As we hire personnel, we do a very, very thorough background investigation. I personally do not want to use forensic resources who are not trained background investigators to do that kind of background work. So what I do is I hire retired members that have that experience and that can work for maybe a week, 10 days to do a background. And that's one of the primary ways I use temporaries. Another way I've used temporaries is I've had individuals in training. I've had an individual retire. I bring them back for a short period of time while I'm training their replacement. So I've used that in a couple instances.
So if we said we don't like temp, you're using so many temporaries, can you think of alternatives? What could you do otherwise to get the work done?
Chair Miller, Senator Troe, what I could do, I personally would hope there's another option. I could pull people off of the scientific bench work and have them do temporary work. That is an option I could do.
Thanks.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I note you have, in addition to yourself as a captain, 7 lieutenants and 15 sergeants, in addition to 65 troopers, senior troopers.
Chair Miller, Senator, Representative Leonard, I assume you're working off of one of our handout sheets.
Correct.
I actually have a total of 15 sworn positions in management. Not necessarily all of those are currently sworn managers at this point because I am in a transition. I also have 30 sworn personnel that are criminalists on the bench. And again, those are the senior people that most of them have 11, 12 years of experience, and those will be transitioning out through retirement.
I was two lines up, Representative Knope got me back. It's actually, I've got one captain, 10 lieutenants, hand out, and 25 criminalists, three.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, the sheet you're looking at is absolutely correct, except for, as Tom Dixon has alluded to, some of the sworn positions were in transition between sworn and non-sworn. So where you see the 10 lieutenants there, that correct figure is 5. The other 5 are managers, but they're in the non-sworn, which would show up. Doesn't change your span of control, but would show up in a different category, whether it's sworn or non-sworn. But he uses lieutenants or manager S to oversee most of his labs.
And our manager S's?
F.
F's, manager F's, are they sworn?
No, sir.
They're civilian employees?
Yes, sir.
So there's 1 captain, 5 lieutenants, 4 sergeants.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, we call them criminalist fours.
It's
a category of supervision within the lab. And if I may, you see 20, I think 5 crim threes, and I mm-hmm. believe the correct number is 23. Mm-hmm. That is not a management position, but that is, again, the civilianization of this lab as we move through the process.
Great. Thank you. Then 5 troopers.
Chair Miller, Representative Letters, if I may, these were the 5 troopers that 4 of them were the latent print examiners, and they're now going non-sworn. So I actually have one trooper. Well, actually, I have two troopers. One's getting ready to retire, and the other would be non-sworn.
Thank you.
Mr. Nicewinder?
Thanks. I just want to make one clarification to something that Tom testified to relative to double fills. There is one other option, and that is the use of limited duration positions, which often may create some issues with recruitment. I know because they aren't permanent, they're made limited duration by DAS in the interim. But that is one alternative to the use of double fills that the agency could use.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee, DAS. Larry's right, that is one option on the double fill. An option on the temporary, really the only option is to create permanent positions and fill people into those permanent positions. I think there are legitimate management reasons why you probably would never be able to completely do away with either double fills or temporaries. We've put a lot of pressure on the department over the years to reduce the use of both of them, and I think they have made very admirable strides in doing so. We continue to talk about that, and your staff is looking at some options on the temporary issue, actually probably to transfer some position authority to temporaries and better reflect how they're using those. Generally, with temporaries, you do have the advantage of fully trained senior officers who are able to come back for short periods of time and do very specific tasks that would be difficult to do otherwise, and you don't pay those folks for PERS while they're doing that, so there are some advantages that probably never be able to completely get away from those. If I could, Mr. Chair. Moving on to page 6, this division is 70.8% personal services, 25.6% services and supplies, and it's showing some of the need for the forensics labs for some additional equipment more than some of the other divisions, and 3.6% capital outlay. Moving on to page 7 and looking at the development of the governor's budget, the only emergency board issue in this division was the salary adjustment. Generally fairly standard current service level issues, the position and standard inflationary changes, the vehicle replacement exception, state government service charge adjustments, phase-in costs for some positions that were established in the budget in 1999, and there's a revenue reduction as a federal COPS universal grant that funded some laboratory technicians expire. Page 8, policy packages. Package 90, the program reductions. There's an elimination of two forensic scientists and criminal history records position and service and supplies reduction. That amount is a $550,000 general fund reduction in three positions. There's anticipated retirement of sworn officers, $145,000 in this division. Adjust for undervilles and sworn positions, only $2,500 in this division. Elimination of LEDS terminal fees, $32,922 and $6,426 other funds. And a reduction in background check revenues as workload generated by the Teacher Standards and Practice Commission for teacher background check reduces, $28,091 reduction in other funds. Package 115 is the OSPO education differential, $432,000 general fund, $13,084 other funds.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Crow.
In package 90, what's the story around eliminating the LEDS terminal fees?
Again, the department has for a number of years used very antiquated LEDS terminals that were expensive to maintain. At the end of this biennium, it is eliminating those and going to alternative methods of having agencies connect with LEDS. And this amount that you've seen in several divisions is just the amount that the forensics division has to pay for the use of those old terminal fees. So it is an efficiency. Although you'll see an increased cost in the LEDS division actually to make up for the charges that are no longer being recovered.
There's also a bill in the Senate right now that would require a background check for all of the volunteer coaches for youth sports. Would you all get to conduct that check, and has anybody arrived at a cost estimate?
Chair Miller, yes, we would be the one to conduct that background check, and we are working with the committee as far as the fiscal impact would be.
Would you guess that it would be every bit the reduction that you're proposing for the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission?
Uh, Chair Miller, at this point, I can't give you an exact answer.
An awful lot of coaches, it would be. Get to go through the privilege of the background check.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, continuing on page 9, policy packages, package 116, funds the reclassification of three positions, $1,964 general fund. Package 118 establishes five other funds position for increased regulatory agency workload in the identification services section. That's $410,000 other funds and five positions. The fee revenues for the background checks will support this. Package 164 is related to the criminal fines and assessment account legislative concept. It reduces revenues by 1,025 other funds, maintaining current service level. Package 169 implements ballot measure 5 on firearms check, firearms background checks. $798,392 other funds, 10 positions, 10 FTEs. And this establishes as permanent positions that were created as limited duration by the emergency board in January 2001. And the package is funded with fee revenues. Package 10, page 10 rather, the fee and revenue changes. The federal COPS universal grant is not backfilled, and one evidence technician position will be phased out. An adjustment of criminal fines and assessment account revenues is based on the legislative proposals. And there are no technical adjustments in this division.
All right, questions? Okay. For the detailed review, Captain.
Thank you, Chair Miller. Again, for the record, Tom Dixon. As far as our program and environmental factors on our detailed program discussion, as you can see, we've taken considerable steps to try to provide the best services we can. I've mentioned one of the challenges is staying in front or working collectively with our partners to help address their growth, as well as ensure we have the personnel in place to meet that growth. Over the last 10 years, our workload in the laboratories has increased by 91%, so it's a very healthy business to be in. The staffing has increased 56%. Part of the reason we've been able to handle that is because of the efficiencies I talked about earlier. As you look into the future, and as you watch television programs, the focus in the use of forensic science does not appear to be diminishing. It's a very capable tool of determining the truth. So if you look at the different environmental factors, courts are expecting forensic science to occur. Citizens watch TV. They expect, well, if it happens here, why doesn't it happen in Oregon? So that expectation's out there. And given those expectations, this division is going to be continued to be faced with a significant growth in the near future. Over the last four bienniums, we've utilized to try to stay in front of this work. We've utilized what we call a gap analysis. We've used trending and workload analysis. On page 10, it talks a little bit about some of the challenges that we have in Oregon in my testimony. There's a chart there that talks about the average number of offenses that go unsolved each year over the last 10 years. As an example, burglaries, 87% of the reported burglaries in Oregon go unsolved. Rapes, 59% of the reported rapes go unsolved. So there's 820 rapes, for example, each year that's unsolved here in Oregon. Now, why I bring that up is as we try to focus and do a better job in law enforcement, this could have a very significant impact on the laboratory system. You mentioned legislation earlier, Chair Miller. There is some legislation that will extend the statute of limitations for rape and sodomy here in Oregon to 20 years. And when you look at 820 of those are unsolved every year, that's more than 16,000 rape cases that your laboratory system may be asked to look at over this 20-year period, continually look at. So there's some work involved with that. On page 11, there's also another chart that demonstrates that currently in Oregon, if you look at crime scenes involving reported person crimes, burglaries, and unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, currently law enforcement is collecting evidence and submitting to the lab less than 10% of those crime scenes. So if all of a sudden, as we realize the value of forensic evidence, as our police departments do a little bit better job in collecting evidence, when we get in 1 in 10 now, it's very easy to increase that workload coming into the laboratory. Based on that and some other projections I'll explain to you here in a few minutes, We anticipate a 17% increase in workload during this next biennium. That would equate to a roughly 21 additional staff. Now, that's a real challenge considering that, in fact, we reduced two staff. DNA, for example, 23% increase, just 2,000 over 1999. So that's an example of a growth. On page 12, every 3 months, we do workload projections, and we've done this back to 1992. You can see by this chart, the work coming into the laboratory is very, very predictable. When we're handling over 34,000 requests a year, it's pretty easy to kind of trend that out and look into the future. This particular chart is all workload. We do a similar chart for DNA for each one of our scientific disciplines so we can project that. Again, as an example, we know that a chemist can do 1,336, we talked about that earlier, or 0.95 analysis per hour. So we have a very high expectation. Another thing we look at, and this is on page 13 of my testimony, talks about the pending, and these are the cases that are in the laboratory today. So if the pending stays relatively flat, that means that we're handling the work coming in at the same pace as it's going out, the same pace as coming in. You can see a slight increase that's occurred on this chart where it's increased from about 2,000 pending to just under 3,000 pending. So it's a slight increase. I think we're doing a good job of managing. But that's something else we look at. The way we've accomplished this in the bottom of 13, like Mr. Nicewinder indicated, you have added resources and been very supportive to your laboratory system over the last three bienniums. Page 14, I talk briefly about a performance measure, which is a turnaround time. And again, this measures our ability to get the work in, get it completed, and get it back out to our customers.
Sure.
Senator Crow.
Your customers think the turnaround time is adequate, is good. Are they pleased generally?
Chair Miller, Senator Crow, one thing you'll find about customers is they always want something faster. But right. For the most part, I believe we're meeting their needs. Our goal is 15 days. It's currently 27. They would like to see it quicker, but I believe they would tell you they're pretty satisfied given the restraints.
Are you comparable with what other states do in terms of turnaround on these things?
Chair Miller, Senator Troll, we're better than some, better than many, worse than some. So I think we're doing a good job.
If you wanted to reach that 15 days rather than the 27, what sort of improvements would you have to make? Would it be more staff, more trained staff? Would it be more equipment? What do you need to do it better?
Chair Miller, Senator Troll, for the most part, it's staff-driven. We've done a lot of work on equipment. There is some efficiencies we'll continue to invest in there. We've trained our customers, working with them to try to make them as efficient as possible so they give us something that will move through quickly. But at this point, most of it's going to be staff-driven.
Thank you. Chair Miller.
Representative Doyle.
Kevin, has there been any cases where I guess there's been concerns that you bump up to the, I guess, is it the 60-day speedy trial issue? If there's some concern where somebody's saying we got to have the trial now as opposed to some kind of holdover that they're saying, well, all we're doing is waiting on forensics, as an example.
Chair Miller, Representative Doyle, yes, those examples happen. The way we deal with that is we have what we call a rush. If they have a deadline that they need to meet, they tell us when they submit the work, and we do everything we can to meet that requirement. There is some exception in the speedy trial for forensic analysis, so that helps also. But it's kind of a balancing act, which I think we do a pretty good job at, given the resources we have.
Has there been any instance where they've had to toss a case just because the, forensics wasn't ready, or that there was some other problem where, it was just they couldn't meet the obligation of, the speedy trial obligation because of a backlog of coming from forensics?
Chair Miller, Representative Doyle, I'm not aware of any in the recent, since I've been the director for 7 years, I'm not aware of case being lost specifically on forensics. I think we're doing a good job there.
Good, thank you.
Okay, to finish up, if I may, talk on page 15 quickly about the national standards. I've talked a lot about efficiency and rapid work, but it's of little value if it's not accurate and quality. Your laboratory system was one of the first five systems in the nation to be accredited in 1985. We've had that for the last 15 years, so we put a lot of value in quality. With quality, though, comes cost. It takes longer to do work if you do it right. But obviously, the trade-off is unacceptable. This is going, currently, we dedicate about seven FTEs to a quality program. That's to everything we do as far as the testing, the proficiency testing, everything that required to meet this accreditation. We know that's going to increase in the in 2004, where we go to another standard, which is called ISO, so that's going to increase as well. The national standards on production, I'm very pleased, and I would say your laboratory system is in the top 10% of the nation with production standards because of all the benchmark work we've done. I'm going to skip over to, I think the essential packages were covered very well by Mr. McGee. I'm going to talk slightly, a little bit more about the program shortfall. Just want to make sure you're fully aware of that. On page 17, there is a graph or a chart that demonstrates what can be expected by the end of the next biennium. The turnaround time will increase significantly. That's back to life. The pending will also increase significantly. Like I said, our pending now is around 3,000. That pending will probably increase to somewhere in the neighborhood to 10 to 15,000. There's going to be more work coming in than we can get out the door. It's as simple as that. I wanted to talk briefly, if I may, about a budget note.
Yeah, Captain.
In your eight labs, do you have facilities for 21 additional positions? I know they're not in the budget, but had they been, where would you have put them?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, yes, we have a facility, considering we are in the process of looking at a new facility for the Portland, a combined facility up there. Given that project moving forward, that there is room within our laboratories to handle the staff.
Thank you.
We do have one budget note that talked about effective scheduling of personnel, and I want to assure you that we've done everything I think reasonable within the laboratory system. We have some laboratories working 7 days a week. We have some working swing shifts. This is pretty unusual in the world of forensic science, but it's something that definitely needs to be done given our focus of providing service. I want to conclude my remarks with simply telling you that your laboratory system will do the very best it can given the resources we have and the work that's put before us. I wanted to end on a very quick story, if I could. A quick war story to kind of bring things into focus. In 1991, there was a murder in the Portland area, and this was an individual that had his throat cut. He was a paraplegic. He was in a wheelchair. He was found in his bed with his throat cut. 1991. In 1992, there was a double murder in the Portland area. A man and a woman up there were murdered. The woman was raped prior to being murdered. In 1995, another rape occurred, this in the Portland area again. Fortunately, the lady was not murdered, but she was raped. In 1997, with your help in 1991, we established our DNA program. A lot of things occurred in the 90s. In 1997, we actually got the evidence from the rape and the double murder, and we were able to say it was the same person. We gave the Portland Police Bureau that information, those leads. They went out, they had a suspect, they confronted this individual, and he denied any involvement in the crimes. Doing excellent police work for the next year, they kept their eye on this individual. They saw him standing on a street, on a sidewalk, smoking a cigarette. He was outside of business, taking a break. He threw the cigarette down on the public sidewalk. They found that cigarette, brought it to the lab, and sure enough, that DNA matched the suspect in these two murders, the double murder plus the rape. Just recently in November, we're reworking old cases. We went into this 1991 murder of the paraplegic that had his throat cut, and we in fact found that the DNA in that case was the same as the other two. So that individual, this last May, he pled guilty to the double murder and the rape, and now has since been charged with yet a third murder as a result of the November casework. I think it's one thing, that individual is going to be very concerned about his DNA, because it was in all three of those cases that that information was critical. With that, thank you, and if you have any questions.
Thank you, Captain. Representative Hansen.
A brief question. All the way through on your charts, we see a real spike in casework in November of 2000. Was there a reason? What was the reason for that particular blip?
Chair Miller, Senator Hansen, very astute. We had our five-year audit, the audit I talked about. We had a five-year audit in November, and we devoted a lot of time and effort, and that slowed some of our casework. December, if you'll notice, it went back down again. So that was our five-year annual audit.
Other questions? Representative Canope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain Dixon, I when you were going through the lab issue and where they're located around the state, you mentioned that you tried to shut one down and that became political, and I understand why you'd run into politics in this building. But if you're going to reorganize, what would be the ideal number of labs that you might have in your system?
Chair Miller, Representative Canope, I'm not here today to be able to give you that exact number. I would like an opportunity to work with our customers, take a look at that during an interim process or sometime hopefully, and come up with what would be best for Oregon, but it could be definitely fewer than eight.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Thank you. Appreciate your testimony very much and the work you do.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next is the medical examiner. And as they come forward, Mr. Nicewender.
Yes. Chair Miller, committee members, again, just briefly, as Karen comes up to the table, this area has seen some budget growth in terms of normal personnel. However, there is no FTE increases that they have seen over time. They are slightly over budget in terms of expenditures. They'll explain to you some of the pressures that they're under with a tox contract. They have a five managers and two non-managers under this division. And essentially the budget is at current service level.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Miller. Good morning, committee members. My name is Dr. Karen Gunson. I'm a forensic pathologist and I'm a state medical examiner for Oregon. I've been with the medical examiner's office for 15 years. The last year and a half, I've been the state medical examiner. State Medical Examiner's Office investigates the deaths that fall under ORS 146, Medical Examiner's Law. About 30% of the deaths in Oregon are reported to our office. Out of that, we have hands-on investigation of about 12% of those cases. And that investigation could include a few phone calls right up to doing a full forensic autopsy plus toxicology work. That law tells us what cases fall under our jurisdiction. Of course, the cases that fall under our jurisdiction will include any accidents, homicides, or suicides. We would provide testimony in court if there is a homicide, and we do the autopsy. Other cases that fall under our jurisdiction include drug-related deaths. That would be anybody who dies as a result of heroin overdose, methamphetamine, cocaine, any other type of street drug, plus all prescription medication overdoses. We just got our numbers in for 2000. We had 209 deaths from heroin, methamphetamine, and cocaine with a big spike in our methamphetamine deaths. We contract with Oregon Health Sciences University to have our toxicology performed by them. They do complete blood work ups on the cases that we request. We are also notified of any deaths that occur outside the hospital. and not under medical care. So anybody who dies at home as a young person not being seen by a doctor would fall under our medical examiner's law and be reported to us. Most of those deaths do turn out to be natural, but in a 20-year-old who dies suddenly and unexpectedly at home, there's a lot of questions that need to be answered about that individual. We also are charged with investigating any deaths that occur in state custody. So anytime somebody dies in the back of a police car, in the penitentiary, in the jail, in the state hospital, those fall under our jurisdiction. We want an independent investigation, a medical investigation of why those occur. And that falls to us to do. Any death that occurs on the job falls under the medical examiner's office jurisdiction. So anytime somebody gets run over by a backhoe, is in a truck accident, we will investigate those deaths, usually doing complete toxicology workups, and we work closely with OSHA, Oregon OSHA, on those particular cases. We also get a fair number of...
Senator Troll.
Does that include work on traffic accidents when the person is working, driving a truck, this kind of thing?
Chair Miller, Senator Troll, that would include that, any of those cases as well. Many times, those cases do turn out to be actual natural disease, somebody who suffers a heart attack on the job as well. We receive all of the unidentified human remains, of course, from around the state, so we do have lots of problems with working up badly charred bodies, decomposed bodies, cases where we only have a couple of bones, and we have a very good working relationship with forensic odontologists, forensic dentists, and forensic anthropologists who help us with those cases, on a volunteer basis, I might add. We're organizationally located within the Intergovernmental Services Bureau of the Oregon State Police, and the system is directed by the state medical examiner with assistance from three other forensic pathologists. We're all located in Portland because that's where most of the action is, so we're in Portland. We do oversee 36 county programs. We're there to support and provide service to them. We provide direct service in the form of autopsies, toxicology, court testimony, and we provide technical assistance to them. We do a lot of talk on the phone with the county medical examiners, district attorneys, defense attorneys, and police agencies around the state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Troll.
When you deal with local government, do you try to recoup any of your costs?
Chair Miller, Senator Troll, no, we do not. We have just two medical transcriptionists who work in our office and support our autopsy service, plus do transcription for the county medical examiners. And we have one forensic administrator, a new position that was created by taking two positions out of the Department of State Police and putting them together to provide us with some support on the non-medical side of what we do. Now, each county, of course, has a county medical examiner, and we're there to provide them with support and service. They are the ones who direct their county medical examiner programs, their local death investigation. The medical examiner's office is not directly linked to any of the benchmarks. We do have performance measures where we attempt to perform autopsies on cases that are reported to our office within 24 hours. We do have certain concerns about our accurate diagnosis and accurate discussion of a manner of death, that is, a homicide, suicide, and accidents. We do have cases, though, where, despite our best efforts, we cannot come up with the cause of death after complete autopsy and toxicology workup. With growth in population comes growth in death. And that is basically what drives our program, is the number of deaths. And we, of course, had, as you can see on page 4, an increase up to 29,346 in 1998, and a marked increase in the number of accidents and drug overdoses, of course, which fall under our purview. Other forces that drive costs in the medical examiner's program are the push at the county level, of course, to have the state take over this medical examiner program completely. and I think we'll see this in the coming years, more and more push towards that. We do feel that it's states responsibility to provide forensic pathology services, but would find it extremely difficult to provide investigative services for each and every county.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Leonard has a question.
Is there a central repository for all death certificates, notwithstanding the cause of death?
Senator Miller, Representative Leonard, yes, there is. The Health Statistics Program for Health Division has a standard repository of all death certificates. We have a repository of all the cases that are investigated by the state by the medical examiner system as a whole in our office.
In addition to those?
Yes, sir.
And are you aware of how far back those death certificates?
I'm not aware of how far the death certificates go, but I am aware that we have records back 25 years for this medical examiner system.
Thanks.
We have 4.26% of our total budget, which goes into administration in the form of our forensic administrator. This person also provides teaching at DPSST and coordinates our teaching programs as well as our budget and so forth. We really don't have any historic or national standard for how much administration should cost for a state medical examiner system. As you can see on page 5, we provide direct service and information to a number of people around the state, a number of agencies, but I think most importantly, we provide information to family members. We are constantly on the phone to people who have lost their loved ones, explaining to them what has happened, and in some cases, what may happen to other members of their family. We also provide information to the health division, obviously through death certificates. We work closely with them as well on the Child Fatality Review Committees around the state. I am, as a matter of fact, the co-chair of the state Child Fatality Review Committee, hoping to affect some change in the health of Oregon through the investigation of death. Obviously, district attorneys, defense attorneys, and the courts rely on our medical information. We go to court routinely to testify on homicide cases and meet with both district attorneys and defense attorneys on these issues prior to court. We are always talking to police agencies when they have a dead person in their particular jurisdiction, and actually usually end up ruling out homicide much more often than we rule in homicide, thereby saving some costs for investigations in those particular cases. We also do a considerable amount of teaching in Oregon, particularly at Oregon Health Sciences University, where our forensic pathologists teach pathology from our point of view, to both medical students and residents. And we teach basic police death scene investigation at DPSST as well.
Representative Smith, a question.
Thank you, Chairman Miller. Does the Oregon Health Sciences University reimburse the state of Oregon for their services?
Chair Miller, Representative Smith, they do not.
Senator Crow?
A couple things. I don't know if you have benchmarks, but turnaround time for your advice, and I guess that would be a key one. How do you do on that?
Senator Miller, Senator Tro, we have a pathologist on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We get back to our constituents within a couple hours of the request, usually right away, but at the most a couple of hours. As a matter of fact, we are developing a questionnaire similar to Captain Dixon's questionnaire. This has never been done for a system before, so we're working on that pretty aggressively to send that out, just to see where we stand. I have not had complaints, but that doesn't mean that people have not been satisfied.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Smith.
Chairman Miller, would it be possible for you to share with us how much time is spent on training and lectures?
Senator Miller, Representative Smith, it depends on what you're talking about. As far as lectures to the medical school personnel, I just completed a 4-hour lecture for the senior medical students up there on Friday, as a matter of fact. A couple hours of prep time went into that. I'll have one coming up for the second year students pretty soon, a couple hours to them as well. We spend a considerable amount of time lecturing to police agencies, district attorneys, and defense association, as well as medical personnel. Just did 3 hours for Fish and Wildlife Division, and we do 4 hours for DPSST about every 6 weeks or so. The ones that we give to other medical professionals usually range around 1 hour or so, and we concentrate, say, for trauma surgeons on what to look for gunshot wounds and so forth.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
I'd be interested in knowing, in particular with OHSU or other institutes of higher education, annually how much time is spent. And then I'd be interested in working with yourself and staff to find out what hourly what you think that time is worth.
Chair Miller and Representative Smith, I'd be happy to provide that information for you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Doyle had a question.
I'm curious, just on at the beginning as you were talking about those investigations that were just required by statute and you had the different categories. Through your experience, have you found that that those categories where you're required by law to investigate, does it make sense to do that? I mean, are there some of those categories maybe that you just as soon say, well, yeah, if it weren't for that, we wouldn't have to touch this, and it's just not necessary. Drug-related deaths is an example. I mean, are those categories ones that you find overall they do make sense, or there's some maybe that we ought to be adjusting to maybe lighten the load?
Chair Miller, Representative Doyle, I think that the categories are adequate. I think that they're where they should be. Now, sometimes what will happen is that we will get a call from the hospital. Somebody comes into their emergency room and dies. They're required to report that to us. After a few questions, we are able to say to them, this does not appear to be something we're interested in. It's not a homicide, it's not a suicide, it's not an accident. I think we need to have a broad range of cases that are reported, throw a broad net to make sure that we're picking up the right cases. For instance, I think it's important to know how many people are dying of amitriptyline overdose. And if we narrowed our focus in the drug category to only street drugs, then we would lose that focus and not be able to say to pharmaceutical people, you know, this is a dangerous drug. In fact, that's what happened with propoxyphene. They didn't realize how dangerous Darvon was until the medical examiner started looking at it. And so I think that we need to throw a broad net, and we have our ways of narrowing it down through our contacts and phone calls so that not every one of these actually gets an autopsy. We don't have the personnel for that.
Right.
So.
Thank you.
Senator Trill?
Your function of educating and sharing your knowledge and so forth through lectures and teaching and other kinds of things, do you find that detracts from your mission or does it add to your mission?
Chairperson and Senator Tro, I find that it adds it to our mission. I think that as physicians, we continually are reviewing the literature. We're continually reading, and I think that this spurs you to do more of that. That just can add to your effectiveness as a physician, as a medical examiner.
Okay. Does it get in the way of your handling the rest of the job?
Senator Tro, I don't feel like that part does. Sometimes I feel like the administration part does.
Okay.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. One last quick question back on the previous questions. Does the Oregon Health Sciences University reciprocate when you need additional education?
Representative Smith, in a way they do. As a matter of fact, the chairman of the Medical Examiner Advisory Board is the chairman of pathology at Oregon Health Sciences University by statute. And there is a considerable amount of give and take between the OHSU and the medical examiner's office as far as exchange of information, particularly in the area of toxicology, where we utilize their PhD toxicologist, thereby precluding the fact that we have to have one. So we do, and there's been a tradition of this give and take where we have pathology residents who are with us for a month that we train, and then we tap into their resources as well.
Representative Dole.
Thanks. And I guess to follow that same line, when OHSU is doing the toxicology reports for you, they don't bill the state for that, do they?
Representative Doyle, they do bill the state for that, and that's part of our shortfall. Over the years, there has been sort of a gentleman's agreement, if you will, between the Medical Examiner's Office and Oregon Health Sciences University. They, in fact, over the years, have not charged us the full amount because of our teaching and so forth. In the last biennia, they felt like they could no longer support that subsidy, if you will, and actually increased our cost for toxicology by about 30%, up to what market standards are, I mean, what they would charge anyone. And that is part of our budget shortfall of about $150,000.
So to follow up, if I guess what it sounds like, even though there's been these past agreements where there's been the sharing of resources, as now one side is starting to say, well, you know, we just can't afford to do that anymore, would you think it appropriate now for you and your division to come back and say, well, we're the same way. We can't afford to take the time away from our other duties unless we get some kind of reimbursement for what we do.
Chair and Representative Doyle, I feel like we need to study those issues and certainly would work with Representative Smith on taking a look at that.
I have a question. I'm just trying to sort out where things kind of fall in place. Where do cause of death issues in terms of like contagious diseases, meningitis, do those fall under your office to investigate, or?
Representative Hansen, some of those do fall under our office because these people die at home. So we have investigated several cases of meningococcal disease where children have died. I, as a matter of fact, have done two autopsies on adults who died of streptococcal meningitis in the same county. So we go back to that county and work with their county health department to try and figure out why these things happen. Why is there this cluster in this particular county? We actually are beginning to develop a close working relationship with CDC in Atlanta on some of these cases where there is no actual, we know it's infectious disease, but we haven't been able to decide what kind it is. And so we've been sending a considerable amount of tissue back there for them to work up for us at no cost to us, luckily.
Who would investigate, for example, like cancer clusters?
Representative Hansen, that would fall under the health division. They have an epidemiology department, and those are the kind of people we would work with, say, on some of the infectious disease things as well.
And the coordination, how do you feel in terms of the coordination and information sharing and stuff between this whole group of medical professionals that are working in this area?
Representative Hansen, I feel like actually over the last few years we've really stepped up our interaction with the epidemiology department, particularly the health division. We're working on several projects with them. Another area where I have felt like we have a lot more interaction is in the area of child deaths, where we have these multidisciplinary groups that meet. So we have a lot more coordination between medical examiners, police agencies, and social service agencies as a result of that.
Thank you.
Mr. McGee.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee, Gas for the record. The budget for this division is $2.3 million general fund, $24,000 other funds. It's a 3.1% increase from the ledge adopted budget, and is essentially the same as current service level. Primarily general fund, again, the small amount of other funds are received for fees for autopsy reports. The governor's recommended budget on page 4, 3.1% increase in total funds. Again, it continues programs at current service level. provides no additional funding for the increasing cost of toxicology and regional medical examiner contract services, and continues planning for the new forensics lab and medical examiner's facility in Portland. Again, no additional funds for that are requested in the budget at this time. Again, we're looking at a single program unit. Personal services are about 63% of this budget, 22.3% is services and supplies, 15% is special payments that are made to counties for under contract for medical examiner services in some counties. Very quickly, through the governor's recommended budget, the only emergency board issue was a salary adjustment. Only current service level issues were the position and inflationary changes and the state government service charge adjustments. There are no policy packages, there are no fee and revenue changes, and there are no technical adjustments.
Just briefly, we have gone from having three forensic pathologists in our program in the mid-1990s and 1980s up to four forensic pathologists. That's driven solely by the population and the number of cases that we've had. There's guidelines in the United States for how many autopsies, how many postmortem examinations forensic pathologists should do. That's about 250 a year. Right now we're at about 200 a year apiece that we do. We, as I said before, are attempting to send out a survey to check our timeliness of turnaround time and so forth. And hopefully I'll report that back the next time I see you. Our current budget, of course, provides for the four forensic pathologists, our one administrator, two medical transcriptionists, toxicologists, and forensic pathology contract services that we have, and 40% reimbursement to counties for autopsy costs that they incur during the year. It's usually about 40%. Obviously, if this is our essential package and if it's not funded, then we won't have a death investigation program in Oregon, and we won't have toxicology services here in Oregon. As you know, we have no reductions and no enhancement packages. And we also have no facilities, but I just want to make a brief comment about our facility in Portland, which is a Multnomah County facility. We've been housed there with the Multnomah County Medical Examiner Program since the mid-60s. It is an old funeral home from 1924, which was converted to a medical examiner office in 1964, and it is completely inadequate and completely outdated, as people know who have been there. And so we have been working
with... Excuse me, Representative Leonard.
Is that the office off of Knott and MLK? That's where you're at?
Chair Miller, Representative Leonard, yes, that is our facility. And we think we've gotten good use out of it over the years, and perhaps it is time to move on. And that's why we're working with Department of Administrative Services to hopefully come up with our plans for a combined facility with Crime Lab, Portland Crime Lab, Medical Examiner's Office, District 1 Headquarters, and Patrol Office to move into a modern medical examiner facility.
Senator Trow.
Is that process underway? Is that going to happen?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, we presented that to an emergency board in November 2000, where they appropriated funds for us to purchase land and continue the architectural plans for that.
Larry?
Just a follow-up question. 2 years ago, there were some concerns surrounding your ability to attract and retain staff, and you had to do some payroll reclassifications as a result. Can you just talk a little bit about your current climate? And
The current climate in the United States for forensic pathology is a tight one. There's only 350 forensic pathologists in the United States who work full-time and do the kind of work that we do. We have seven, actually, here in Oregon. We are working towards recruiting a replacement for Dr. Luman over the next couple years. We are considerably hampered in that by our facility. Because of how inadequate it is. So I'm hoping that we can move forward with this facility and attract good candidates for our particular position.
We have seven out of 350?
Correct.
Just right. Seven per state?
Yeah, I was going to suggest that other states probably have a few more deaths, at least some of them.
other state, Chair Miller, other states do, there are other, we work full-time, so there's 350 full-time. There's many, many forensic pathologists who work part-time as forensic pathologists and part-time in hospital administration kind of things or hospital labs. The reason that they do that is because of the money. They can make a whole lot more money working in the private sector and just doing forensic pathology on a contract basis or on a case-by-case basis than they can working full-time. Because as you work for the state or county, you make considerably less money than you would if you worked in the private sector.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
I hope this is totally irrelevant, but how does it work in terms of the donor program on accidental deaths, and are you able to coordinate that well, or is there any problems in...
Chair Miller, Representative Hansen, actually we're on the board, the medical examiner is on the board of the various organ procurement organizations, and we work very closely with them. Our feeling is every organ, every time that we can give, and so we report to them to have them follow up.
Good, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. The schedule suggests that we might get to the next category, State Fire Marshal, if time permits, but I think it might be better, unless the committee objects violently, that we take that up tomorrow morning at 8:30. Sorry to inconvenience those who have come and were prepared to testify today, but I think that would be better. Also, I wanted to advise for those of who are here or listening or find out that Wednesday we will be having the opportunity to receive some public testimony on this budget, so let that word go out. Get some final input before we work the budget, and we're scheduled to do that on Thursday. Is there anything further to come before the committee?
We're not going to do the State Farmer.
No. Oh. I want you to have more time to understand the program.
Well, today is Fire Service Day. I thought it would be a perfect time to have the new Fire Marshal make a presentation.
I hope you have the new Fire Marshal come up and say something about that if you'd like before we go.
That'd be great.
Would you like to come forward and talk about Fire Service Day?
He's going to hate me after this.
Good morning. Welcome. Chair Miller, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Garrison. I serve as the State Fire Marshal. And as Representative Leonard has mentioned, today is Fire Service Day in the Capitol. We have displays set up. We, the Fire Service generally, have displays set up in the lobby, informational displays. We have fire chiefs wandering around the building in uniform. They're pretty easy to spot. We have some equipment outside from some of the fire departments. We're attempting to provide information to all of the legislators on the programs that the fire services provides and what some of the challenges are that the fire service is trying to deal with. Hopefully some of you will have contact in your offices with some of the fire chiefs. I know they're attempting to schedule some time with a variety of legislators. So it is primarily informational. We hope you'll take advantage of the opportunity to visit with the people. We have some outstanding experts here to provide information for you, and if you get the time, I would encourage you to visit with them and take advantage of that opportunity.
Well, thank you, Representative Leonard.
I would add, Chair Miller, that Bob Garrison was just sworn in last week as the state's latest fire marshal, and the fire service is extremely pleased with his appointment, and he has just been an outstanding member of the fire service community for a long time. We're very proud to have him there.
Congratulations.
Representative Leonard, thank you very much.
Anything further before the committee? If not, again, thank you for coming, and we'll visit your displays today.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.